Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. I'm Al Ross, and it's time for our weekly extravaganza called Spectrum West. Welcome. Today, we'll talk about the existing and growing support for the Confluence Project in downtown Eau Claire. Jim Oliver's here with news about Willy Wonka, who's opening tonight, Thursday, in Menominee. Jim will also preview some of what's on stage in Western Wisconsin. Advertising shapes American life, and our guest knows a thing or two about aspects of the craft. And we commence the good ship Culture Pop with this. Namji Kim is an associate professor of music at UW Eau Claire. She plays piano primarily. Come Saturday evening, she will visit another UW campus. This is UWBC in Rice Lake, to occupy a bench in front of an 1891 Steinway piano. It recently emerged from a total restoration. Ms. Kim will share the stage with Aurelien Petiot, another UWEC music mentor and virtuoso of the viola by choice. To make her acquaintance and find out more about the Saturday event, I stopped by Kim's piano studio at the university on Tuesday. I read that you started playing the piano at age 6.
Yes.
And then you had your first concert at 8.
That's correct.
Wow. Was that because you loved music? Were you expected to play the piano? Did you have a musical family? Or tell us about that.
Well, my family loves music. My parents love music. My mother studied a little piano. My father studied a little theory. But none of them is a professional musician, but they love music. They encouraged me to pursue my piano study, and I really love music.
What was that first concert like at age 8? Was it scary? You know, or it could have been become a revelation. You could have said to yourself, man, I really like doing this. I'm going to do more of this.
It was almost half a century ago.
Well, that's okay. So we all remember our first.
The thing that I remember is that my mother had my hair permed.
She did.
My hair became too curly. That's one of the things that I remember. I was a little nervous, but I really enjoyed playing.
Where was
I
the
loved
concert?
Playing. It was in Paris, actually, a suburb of Paris, in a theater.
Okay.
So I do remember also that I got some flowers at the end.
You did?
Yeah.
Do you remember what you played?
Yes, I played some pieces by Debussy. I don't recall exactly which pieces, and I played some variations by Beethoven. Yeah.
So it wasn't just chopsticks.
No.
And I also, in reading about you, read Juilliard. Someone hears Juilliard, they go, ah, Juilliard. Tell me about the Juilliard experience. I mean, that's perceived, at least in America, as the Harvard of music.
My recollections of Juilliard are very numerous. And it was a mixture of many different things. I remember that the atmosphere was very competitive, but I felt I learned a lot. And I remember the teaching from my former teacher, Georgi Shador, very vividly.
Did you have any preconceived notions as to what it was going to be like? Did it turn out to be tougher than you imagined it would be? Or was it easier? Or was it about what you imagined?
Well, I think that I had a much tougher time in Paris, actually, at the Paris Conservatoire. It was very tough because at the Paris Conservatoire, you are expected to graduate on time. If you didn't get the first prize on graduation at the third try, you were considered to be fired or kicked out, as
really?
You say. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they only accept 20 students out of 400 piano auditions every year after rigorous, you know, entrance examinations. So that was very tough. So I was prepared, actually, mentally to go to Juilliard. So Juilliard, after the Paris Conservatoire, seemed pretty mild in comparison.
Let's talk now about your partner in Saturday's concert, Aurelien Petiot.
Yes.
I've had him on the show several times. I love talking to him because I love to listen to people do the French. He plays the viola by choice. He loves to play the viola. He's kind of a free spirit, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I love his open-mindedness. And he's so cheerful, pleasant, easy to work with. He's very, very musical. And he has a wonderful imagination. He loves to use the word imagine. And I also feel the same. I always tell my students, imagine this, imagine that. And he's able to connect various arts with music. So he's very well-read, very knowledgeable, not just in music, but in many other things. And he's musician with very rich background.
Are there a number of pieces written for piano and viola, or are these interpretations of things?
Well, the viola repertoire, you know, is not huge. However, the sonatas that we are going to play, the sonata by Rebecca Clark, is a wonderful, wonderful work. It's very romantic, it's rich, it's lush. It has echoes of Ravel's music, of Debussy's music, and some traces of Irish folk music. Mm-hmm. So, and the composer, who was a woman composer, was very unfairly judged by her contemporaries. So her work deserved to be known.
Our guest is Namji Kim. We're in her office, actually, at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. She's an associate professor of music. She's playing an 1891 Steinway piano at UW Barron County in Rice Lake Saturday evening at 7:30 in the Fine Arts Theater there. Let's talk about playing that instrument. Is this a milestone in your career? Is this kind of like playing a Stradivarius?
Well, it's probably the oldest Steinway that I will touch, because I didn't try the piano yet. I cannot wait.
What do you expect when you sit down at it?
You know, I expect everything. When I say expect everything, I expect all good things, all bad things. That way I'm not disappointed.
Now, you told me old pianos or pianos themselves are like wine. You used that quote. I thought that was kind of neat.
Well, if it is well restored, that depends on the piano technician, on the temperature. You know, if the humidifier doesn't work very well in a concert hall, then even the best piano will turn into lemon. So I have that experience of playing a piano in a university, not here. And they bought a Steinway like 1 or 2 years ago, and it's already having some problems because of a lack of humidifier.
Do you think, knowing pianos as you do, are new pianos better constructed than old pianos? Or are they just differently constructed?
They are differently constructed.
Okay.
You know? And in the time of Chopin, you know, Chopin used a pleyel. And that pleyel was reputed to have a very silvery, kind of thinner sound. Mm. But a sound which allowed performers to shape, you know, many kind of colors. The Erard, you know, that was used by Liszt, had already finished a beautiful tone, but maybe it didn't allow performers to have many different kind of sounds, mm-hmm. because the player had a kind of thinner sound, so you are forced to kind of develop, you know, your own sound as a piano.
As has been the case with a lot of music professors that I speak with at universities all over, you teach, obviously, but it's also important to perform. Tell me about the importance of performing to keep an edge as a teacher, as an educator.
That's very important because I can relate to my students when they prepare for performance. I can understand how they feel before performance, and I can empathize with them. It's not always pleasant the day before performance. You feel nervous, you want to do well because it's so important to you, you don't want to disappoint your audience. So I've been through that many, many times. And the thing is that you cannot fight your nervousness, you have to live with it. If you try to fight it, then it jumps back at you again. Several friends of mine who also went to Juilliard once told me in exasperation that they give many concerts and they don't understand why they are still very nervous before the concert. But that's to be expected. Mm-hmm. If the performance is not important to you, you would not be nervous. You would take it all easy, you know. But it's because it's so important to you that it becomes difficult. I try to tell my students, you know, nervousness is part of the whole performance mm-hmm. process. No pain, no gain.
That's right. The word nervous kind of sometimes feels negative. I mean, I think it's more of an excitement to perform. Believe it as that.
Yes.
It becomes something different.
But then when you create something, and performance is also an act of creation, because without the performance, the music remains dead letter. We have to give life to the piece of music. The act of creation involves an element of suffering. That's to be expected. And all you can do is to accept the suffering.
Really?
Yeah. We all have a different concept of suffering. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes to suffer. Nobody likes to receive criticism, even constructive criticism. But in order to learn, you have to receive constructive criticism. You have to be able to accept it and learn upon it. Mm-hmm. It's important to have that negative side, that darkness, in order to be able to improve. Because without darkness, we cannot improve. Without failure, we cannot improve. But at the same time, we shouldn't lose confidence in ourselves. Confidence in our potentials. But if we are always to succeed, then we cannot really progress.
Mm-hmm. And without darkness, there's no appreciation for light.
That's it. Yes. Without darkness, there's no light.
Final question, and this is only because I'm a curious individual.
That's all right. I'm curious too.
When you talked about nervousness, have you ever known anyone who was just an excellent musician who literally had to give it up because they just couldn't take performing?
Yes, that happened to many great pianists, actually.
Really?
Yes. They just couldn't stand to go on stage. I have that former classmate from the Paris Conservatoire. He used to play everything from memory. Several years ago, he decided to play with music. That didn't diminish his success in any way. He still, you know, has wonderful, successful concerts, but he plays with music. And I asked him why he plays with music, and he told me that he had nervous breakdown, and that affected his brain somewhat. So I can understand that.
Oh, really?
Yes, it can be very damaging.
Mm-hmm. So now what are you playing on Saturday?
I'm playing Schumann Fantasy. I'm playing the Bach Toccata in D major, and Aurélie and I are going to play the Rebecca Clark Sonata for viola and piano.
Rebecca Clark didn't sound like a classical composer to me.
I had a total surprise when I heard it for the first time on YouTube. It was a revelation.
Oh, really?
Yes, I loved it. I fell in love with that music right away. So romantic, so passionate, so powerful, so intense. It just took my breath away.
Are you an intense performer like Aurélien is?
I'm very intense. I wish sometimes I wouldn't be that intense, but that's who I am.
Stay who you are, because it's been fun talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Namji Kim, another of the wonderful educators who shape our young people at one of the fine venues for higher learning in Western Wisconsin. The concert is Saturday evening at 7:30 in the Fine Arts Theater at UW Barron County in Rice Lake. Notable instruments complement notable artists, and vice versa. That was fun. By the way, next week we'll talk with the man who restores pianos, including that 1891 Steinway in Rice Lake, Chris Tursky on Spectrum West. The pros of the confluence, coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls, dedicated to challenging the people of the Chippewa Valley to move 15 minutes a day, any way that works. More at GoChippewaValley.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Home Builders Association. The annual Home and Garden Show comes to the Eau Claire Indoor Sports Center February 21st through 23rd. Ticket information is available at cvhomebuilders.com.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Nice to have you along today. In just a few weeks, residents of the city and county of Eau Claire will be voting on two referenda, one on the city ballot and another for county residents, each indirectly linked to the Confluence Project, a proposed complex of two structures in downtown Eau Claire, where the Eau Claire and Chippewa Rivers meet. A collaboration between private and public entities comprised of student housing, retail space, and an overdue Center for the Performing Arts. On April 1st, the question on the city referendum will read, shall a charter ordinance be enacted that would require a binding referendum before $1 million or more in city funds can be expended on any building construction that is planned for dramatic, musical, or artistic performances? So if you live in the city of Eau Claire, you'll be voting on whether or not to have another referendum. The referendum singles out the arts, something for which Eau Claire and Western Wisconsin are well known. There's more to it, and we'll get into that in a moment. County residents will vote to support or not the board's past resolution to contribute $3.5 million to the project, paid back over 10 years, adding about $6 to the property tax on a $100,000 home. So that's the surface. There is a group called Voices for Growth. Its mission is to spread facts out on the table for all to see. James Hankey is one of those Voices for Growth, and I invited him for a chat just the other day.
A little bit in terms of my background, I practice economic development as a profession and have done a fair amount of work in downtown redevelopment and revitalization, not just here within the Chippewa Valley, but throughout the state of Wisconsin. Given the project and its nature, have watched this issue unfold very closely. I did my undergraduate work at UW-Eau Claire, so do have a strong affinity for the community and the university. I have a high level of appreciation for the university's interest in extending outward and being a more integral part of the community as well. And so as I look at the components that comprise the Confluence Project, I see a lot to like, and I have some real concerns as it relates to, in particular, the negative and forced referendum question that has been thrust upon us at the city level. And so have been involved with an organization called Voices for Growth, developed to encourage people to vote no on the city's referendum, and also to encourage people to vote yes at the county level, where they're asking the very simple question, do you or do you not wish for the county to make an investment in the Confluence Project? I think that you're seeing a coalition developing here that includes people from all across the political spectrum, and I do think that creates some potential for future dialogue about where we take growth within the community, in particular downtown redevelopment.
An important question for people out there would be, have the developers done their homework?
The developers have done an extensive amount of homework. One of the things that's been lost in this whole discussion is the amount of time, effort, and energy the development group mm-hmm. have outlaid toward this project. They have been very thoughtful, very deliberative, and they have designed a project whereby the increment generated from the additional growth associated with the mixed-use building will then cover the city's investment, the $5 million investment in the Performing Arts Center. Mm-hmm. They've been very collaborative as it relates to working with a variety of stakeholders, Eau Claire Regional Arts Council, the University Foundation and their real estate group, and they've cultivated what is, to a certain degree, a somewhat complex project. But I think they put all the pieces together to ensure a high level of success associated with the project.
What about the idea of the referendum itself? Now, that's coming up on the 1st of April. Referenda are to have the blessing of citizens, but in my mind, only if that blessing is bestowed through factual, rational, and accurate debate, which includes a clear, concise articulation of what exactly is being voted on. Are there concerns about the fact, there's that word again, fact, that there may be some things out there that aren't factual and rational and et cetera?
Yeah, there are some real concerns as it relates to that. And I answer that question, and it's a question I get often, and I answer that question in two ways. You know, what you saw at the county board was a 21-5 vote in support of a $3.5 million county investment in the Confluence Project and in the Arts Center. There was a caveat that was included, and that caveat was a referendum vote at the county level asking people, do you wish to make this investment, yes or no? That makes all the sense in the world, mm-hmm. and I applaud the county board and those who made the decision to include that referendum question. The city referendum is quite a bit more challenging. Number one, the city council, by an 8-3 vote, made a $5 million commitment to the Confluence Project utilizing tax increment finance, not utilizing our property tax dollars, not utilizing general purpose revenue dollars. Mm-hmm. They made that commitment, and included in that commitment were a series of caveats. The mixed-use component needs to have a valuation of $21.5 million or more. The state needs to make its investment. You know, the philanthropy piece of this has to include a certain amount of money. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, and I really appreciated the thoughtfulness that came from the city council on this, in addition, you need a $2.5 million endowment to serve as a backdrop to the project. So, you know, the city council goes through this process. There is a significant amount of public debate. We elect our city council members to make these types of complex decisions. Mm-hmm. They make the decision. They make the vote. It passes 8-3. And then we see a referendum question pop up. And the referendum question isn't a referendum on the confluence. The referendum question is a question of whether or not we should have future referendums each and every time the city invests more than $1 million in an arts or arts-related project. Here are my real concerns about that. One is, I'm not convinced that even if this referendum were to pass, that it would effectively undo the commitment that the city has already made to the Confluence Project. Number two, I'm very concerned about how we are going to get to a point where we understand the definition of what an arts or an arts-related facility is. Mm-hmm. What we have basically done with this referendum question is we've positioned the city to spend our money in court debating this issue, and I think that that is poor public policy. And third and most important, I think if we are going to entrust and empower our elected officials to make a decision and vote on a $60 million budget, using our tax dollars, by the way, when they're making that decision, I think that we should empower them as well to make a strategic investment in a project like this through the utilization of tax increment finance. It's one thing when you have people voting when it's their tax dollars at stake. It's an entirely different question when you're asking people to make a decision on a project that's utilizing a vehicle like tax increment finance to make the investment. I also have some real concerns on the unintended consequences of this referendum as it relates to economic development in the community.
Give us TIF 101.
Tax increment financing is a state statutorily empowered tool that gives municipalities the ability to create what are called tax increment finance districts. In creating a district, what you're doing is you're establishing a geographic boundary within your community. Tax increment finance districts are used for redevelopment, eliminating blight and creating conditions of growth within downtown areas, and also promoting industrial development. When you create the tax increment district, you establish what's called a base value. That's the current value of the property within the tax increment district.
Okay.
So using the Confluence Project as an example, the property is currently valued at about $2.1 million. That becomes the base value of the district. Mm-hmm. All of the taxing entities that receive the taxes from that $2.1 million will continue to receive their tax dollars going forward. Any additional growth and development that occurs within that district is then captured by that tax increment district to make some of the strategic investments necessary to facilitate growth. So in this case, the two components of the project include a $50 million performing arts center and also a $21.5 million mixed-use facility. That mixed-use building will be a taxed, privately owned building. What we have then is through that $21.5 million mixed-use building, $19.3 million in tax increment. That tax increment is then taxed. Mm-hmm. So the developers still paying the full tax load on a $21.5 million building. That $19.3 million creates about $500,000 in tax increment on an annual basis. That tax increment is then what is utilized to make the $5 million investment on behalf of the city and the Performing Arts Center.
James Hanke with us on Spectrum West. We're talking the Confluence Project. Is the bottom line issue here, James, the fact that we're being asked to look through or swim through muddy water?
Right, and that's our primary focus, is ensuring that people have accurate and up-to-date information as it relates to the two referendum questions. We are, as a referendum action committee, encouraging people to vote no on the city's referendum question, and we're encouraging people to vote yes at the county level, whether or not the county should make the investment in the Confluence Project.
How did the referendum get worded? How did it get that way?
You know, it's a fantastic question, and one that's tough to answer. My sense is that there were a number of individuals that encouraged the city council to put a referendum question on the ballot. And I think the city council considered that and said, we're not utilizing taxpayer dollars to make this investment. The $5 million comes from tax increment financing. The increment comes from the $21.5 million mixed-use facility and portion of the project. There's sufficient increment to cover the investment. it doesn't need a referendum. So the city went ahead and voted on an 8-3 vote to go ahead and make the investment. At that point, you then saw a group of citizens who then spent some time going around collecting signatures, telling people that by signing the petition, they were supporting a question on the Confluence Project and including that question on the April ballot. They came to the realization that you can't undo city action by a referendum, so they decided to reword the question and make it a catch-all. Our focus over the course of the next, 6 weeks or so is just really educate, communicate with folks about the issue, ensure that those who are going to the polls on April 1 are making a choice based on a good understanding of the facts and the data that are involved.
People listening have questions. How do they get answers from you?
Sure. There are really two ways, and there will be more in the future, but the two key ways right now are through our website, which is voicesforgrowth.org, and also folks on Facebook can sign up to like our Voices for Growth page and can garner some additional information that way. A couple of other sites that have been around and available, Community for the Confluence being one of them. Also, we've seen a lot of active support coming from our local Chamber of Commerce. Their board unanimously voted to support the city's investment in the project after doing some significant analysis, and they too are spending some time working with their constituency and their members around the issue.
There was also more news of a contribution just Monday.
Yeah, that came from Charter Bank. And what I really liked about their commitment, they're turning their commitment into a matching pledge. Yeah. That's another way to encourage some folks to really start thinking thoughtfully about making the strategic investments in this. The philanthropy piece of this is about a $12 million piece. And to date, you're looking at about $4 million committed to the project. Some big investments from folks like RCU, Champ Software, and some others. The university, through their foundation, is running two campaigns for some folks like myself that aren't ready to write that six-figure check. Mm-hmm. They have what's called a 50 for 50 campaign, 50 individuals making a commitment of $50,000 for a total of $2.5 million in commitments, a 40 for 40 campaign that will result in $1 million commitment from folks that are willing to commit $2,000 a year over 5 years toward the project. I'm one of those folks that believes in putting my money where my mouth is. I will be making a commitment to the project, and I'm very appreciative of a number of folks that are matching that gift, and it feels pretty good to be a part of something like that.
Spectrum West, of course, deals with the arts and music and culture of Western Wisconsin. The worst thing I think we can do is come up with an us versus them mood. It's us together no matter what.
And I would agree.
Let's say the referendum passes.
If the city referendum passes, we are then set up to have a second referendum in the fall, but it'll be too late. By then, the university will have continued down their path of acquiring the state dollars necessary to do something, and they're not going to wait for a second referendum. I'm afraid the university very likely will go ahead and shift to a project they will do entirely on their own, and they will likely do on campus.
Having a facility of that type is in their master plan. If possible, they'd love to work with the community. You know, the interesting thing is there are a lot of people in the state of Wisconsin watching this process. It's a new model, and yes. I think a lot of folks out there would like to see it work.
And I would agree. And you know, it's interesting, over the course of the last couple of weeks, I've spent a fair amount of time down in Madison and have talked with a variety of legislators and those in a number of the different cabinets about the issue. And oftentimes it's not me bringing it up. It's them learning that I'm from Eau Claire and asking me what my thoughts are on this. There's a great interest in this. And there's a great interest in this because I think this is becoming a model that does a couple of really key things. And one that's also important to me is it's a model that has the potential to reduce the overall taxpayer burden associated with making these types of investments. Mm-hmm. If the university goes out and does their own thing on campus, it's likely it won't be a $25 million investment. It's likely it'll be closer to a $30 million investment, and taxpayers will pay that difference. Yeah. If we don't do something collaboratively, it's very likely that the community is then going to end up having to do something, and it's very likely that it would cost the city more. It's not often that you find yourself looking at an opportunity that creates the type of win-win scenario that those engaged in this project have created. Mm-hmm. They've been incredibly deliberative and thoughtful in their efforts. I applaud the university in their desire to be more engaged with the community, and I'd like to suggest that the community be a little bit more engaging toward the university. 30 years ago, this was a union manufacturing town, large corporations that employed a significant number of people, and the university, by comparison, was a relatively small part of the economic pie here in the community. That dynamic has changed, and the university has become a much more integral part of the economic well-being of this community. And I think that there are many on the city council, and there are many in city administration that understand that. It's unfortunately clear there are some that don't, and I think that we need to do a better job educating about the symbiotic relationship and the value that both can bring to one another.
Mm-hmm. James Hanke, one of many voices for growth, the Confluence Project. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
As you know, Spectrum West is all about the people who bring us that which is deemed artistic, music, art, literature, ways we express ourselves. As its host, I'm a promoter of their present and optimistic for their future. I personally encourage their continuation and hope for every opportunity of enhancement. Many theater companies, galleries, and venues work hard to maintain what is often an uphill existence. I find myself applauding more vigorously when they look for and find ways of mustering an endurance that will bring them the same enjoyment and enrichment to generations of tomorrow. Those generations need us working together now, just like those before provided for ours. I say keep up the good work and do like our rivers do. Come together to make an even wider, deeper, and stronger current. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for a good cup of Joe. That's J-O, the initials for Jim Oliver, our correspondent extraordinaire. He's found another Western Wisconsin theater production to preview, and I, for one, am very anxious to hear all about it.
Opening tonight, Thursday, at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee is the Menominee Theater Guild production of the musical Willy Wonka. Joining us to talk about the show is Blaine Halverson, who is Executive Director of the Theater Guild. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
The children's author Roald Dahl wrote the kids' classics Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach, among many other famous works. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory has performed the basis for a couple of films and the musical play Willy Wonka. So tell us about the Menominee Theater Guild production.
Well, we have a rather large cast. I wanted to include a lot of kids. I think they bring a lot of energy to the show. And so what we actually did was we cast 35 kids to play the roles of Oompa Loompas and Swirls and Charlie's neighborhood friends, and kind of had separate rehearsal sessions for kind of the principal cast of the evening, and then we had 3 weeks of after-school program rehearsals for those kids playing Squirrels and Oompa Loompas and Charlie's friends, and they kind of brought them all together a couple weeks ago. So there's a lot of energy to this show. Very energetic group of people who just bring a lot to the stage every time they walk on it.
Now, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory came out after I was reading kids' books. So can you tell me a little bit about the story?
Well, the story is about a boy named Charlie who's a very poor child and lives in a poor family where his four grandparents share a bed. And they live in the same town as a very famous candy maker, Willy Wonka, who has a factory. And Charlie's grandfather worked there his whole life. And there's a special kind of contest where Willy Wonka is going to give a tour to five lucky children who manage to get a golden ticket out of a chocolate bar. And Charlie wins one of those golden tickets and goes on the tour, and they win a lifetime supply of chocolate as well. And he goes on the tour with these other kids, and they have various adventures, I guess. And it really is about, how to put it, it's about what a child should be like in a lot of ways. Uh-huh. It deals with character. It deals with decency and compassion and honesty, mm-hmm. these kinds of themes.
Now, as you said, it's a pretty large cast, but can you tell me who the main characters are and the actors who play them?
Certainly. We have a young man named Jonathan Hillman.
Okay.
Is the young man who plays Willy Wonka. Mm-hmm. And he has done a lot of shows here in Menominee over the years, in his younger years. And I was just had the fortune of being with him on stage in Importance of Being Earnest this last fall. And he just brings a lot of... He's really experimented a lot with physicality and voices, and tries to make that character a lot of guesswork for the audience. How's he going to react? What's he going to say? What's he going to do? And then we have an 11-year-old, actually, he just turned 12, now I remember 2 weeks ago, named Justice Sotkowski, who is playing Charlie, who's new to our stage, but he's just really gifted and an absolutely tremendous singing voice that... first time it came out of the auditions, my mouth about dropped to the floor.
Hmm. So. Now, since there are a lot of kids in the show, and it's kind of a kid show, is this something that adults would enjoy as well?
Oh, definitely. The humor is good for kids and adults. There's a lot of, when you think about it, the original book was from the 60s, and the first movie was in 1970 or 71, I think, with Gene Wilder. So, you know, if you were 12 or 13 years old then, you're in your mid-50s now. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's going to be interest across the generations for a show like this.
Sure. I assume you have a musical director, choreography, that sort of thing?
Yeah, actually we had two people kind of collaborating on music. We had special kind of specializing going. So Nathan Jacobson did the vocal direction. He is the conductor, director of the Menominee Singers, and he also appears in the show as Mr. Bucket, Charlie's dad. And then Terry Morse, a local musician, is conducting the pit for us.
Well, he is Blaine Halverson, who is executive director of the Menominee Theater Guild and directing the production of Willy Wonka. I always like to ask about the set. Is this a pretty elaborate set for a show like this?
I don't know if it's elaborate. It's very creative and flexible. We have a small space at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee, and we have to do a lot of different scenes. So what we tried to do is kind of build a composite set with different pieces that can be moved and then painted them in different ways and different sides in the sense so we could shift the direction that they were on stage and make them look different and give the entire appearance of being in a completely different room of the factory.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of fun with that, and there's a lot of creative people. That some very, you know, we're fortunate to have some really talented artists because of UW Stout and their tremendous art program here. And we had several graduates, faculty members, and students from Stout who contributed. We have three really great mural drops that are part of the show as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's coming up next for the Menominee Theater Guild after this is over with?
Holding auditions very soon here for Lost in Yonkers, the Neil Simon play. And Mike Cook, who many people know from Eau Claire, he does a lot of shows at Fanny Hill. He's directed for Chippewa Valley Theater Guild many times as well and appeared in shows for them and for Eau Claire Children's Theater. And mm-hmm. Mike is going to be directing that show for us this spring.
When this time of the year rolls around, has work started yet on the next season?
Actually, we've been having conversations about that, and it appears that our committee is kind of narrowed it down to between four and six shows that they're going to select from, and we're hoping to have that decision made in March.
Mm-hmm. How many shows do you have in the season? I didn't go back to count on your website. So.
We've typically been doing four as part of our main stage, mm-hmm. and then we generally do three youth productions a year. We do a summer day camp production, and then we usually do an after-school program for elementary and middle school age kids,
mm-hmm.
and then another one for middle and high schoolers. This year, as I was directing Willy Wonka, we kind of combined the after-school program with that production, in essence. So,
mm-hmm.
Involving as many kids as we normally do, but working with it on a main stage production instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been visiting with Blaine Helverson, who is executive director of the Menominee Theater Guild. Tonight, Thursday, the company opens a production of Willy Wonka. The show plays through Sunday and next Thursday through Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. For ticket information, you can call 715-231-PLAY. Blaine Helverson, thanks so much for coming on again and talking to us.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate your time.
Jim Oliver, who exemplifies what Spectrum West is all about, people doing what they like to do and sharing it with others. Thanks, Jim. Speaking of UW Barron County, as we were a while back about the piano, I ran across a piece about one of its own, Dr. Quentin Varaghy, writing a chapter for a book about the power of advertising. The book's called We Are What We Sell, How Advertising Shapes American Life and Always Has. He wrote one of the chapters called Product Placement in the Golden Age of Radio, Why Tina Fey Owes a Debt of Gratitude to Jack Benny. My first question to him was about whether or not one has to believe the claim, we are what we sell, in order to write a chapter within the book.
Well, that's interesting. I would assume that no. The editors of the book, I know Bob Batchelor personally, and I think that he would be more than welcoming to someone challenging that notion. Sometimes the most interesting chapters are those that challenge preconceived wisdom. Indeed, someone who did challenge that notion that we are what we sell would probably have very sort of enticing and interesting chapter to read. They sort of cover basically 100 years of advertising, and it's a three-volume set dealing with everything from, for instance, there's a chapter on Lyndon Johnson's famous Daisy ad, chapter, I believe, like on football advertising. And then there's my chapter, which is on the Golden Age of Radio. My assignment was simply to find some sort of angle to talk about in terms of the Golden Age of Radio. And ever since I was in the eighth grade, I've been listening to various programs. I've noticed that an interesting spin on radio broadcasting was the way they brought in the advertising. And so that is how I got involved with the project, at least in a sense.
Yeah, I've been a student of advertising and marketing. I've done as much reading as I can. I have my own opinions, my own take on things. So I was really absorbed in this stuff. In fact, I may end up getting the book in which your chapter appears. Your chapter, by the way, so that people understand, is called Product Placement in the Golden Age of Radio, or Why Tina Fey Owes a Debt of Gratitude to Jack Benny. Why does Tina Fey owe a debt of gratitude to Jack Benny?
Well, they both broke the fourth wall. So in theater, there's the concept of breaking the fourth wall, which means acknowledging the fact that you're on the stage and that the audience is in the audience. If you watch the TV show 30 Rock, they're constantly making self-referential jokes about the fact that it's a show. Mm-hmm. The title of the show itself is called 30 Rock. It's a reference to the location of NBC. And Jack Benny's radio program, which lasted several decades, was the same way. It was a show about a show. They both use similar types of humor. What I focused on was the way in which Benny incorporates his advertising into the humor and into the show itself so as to advertise the products, whether it be Lucky Strike cigarettes or Jell-O or what have you, into the program itself so that people would pay attention and listen to it as they're laughing. And the ways in which modern-day programming uses that same sort of technique, what we call product placement, and the ways in which they use it in sort of a self-referential fashion. And so Tina Fey is a great example of that. If you watch 30 Rock, they have product placement, but they will acknowledge the fact that it's product placement. So it's ridiculous so much that it's disarming and you don't mind the fact that you're being advertised to while you're being entertained.
I was fascinated by the term meta-drama or meta-theater. The way it's defined is comedy and tragedy at the same time. Modern Family is another good example, in my mind, of a situation comedy in which they continually lead you to remember that they're just on TV and they're talking to you. Because a lot of times the players in that show will look at the camera as if they're looking at the audience and going, wow, did you believe I just said that? Which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I think we see that that sort of breaking of the fourth wall in a lot of TV shows, you know, going back decades. There's, you know, the TV show The Office There was one, I'm thinking back from the 60s, it escapes my memory, but one of the side characters was Maynard G. Krebs. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
That was Dobie Gillis.
Yeah, where he breaks the fourth wall as well. But what's interesting is, you know, this is something that happens over and over again, this type of breaking of the fourth wall. But some programmers take it a step forward and use that metadramatic technique to sell a product. And I think that the best example of that in the 21st century is the Colbert Report. He does this all the time. He had this running gag probably for months, if not years, where he would have a Starbucks barista underneath his desk. Every time he wanted Starbucks, he would have it right underneath his desk. It played right into his fictional character's narcissistic tendencies, but it was also sort of a very clever way of advertising Starbucks. The reason I think it works is because it plays into the audience's sense of sophistication and intelligence. Mm-hmm. Instead of being offended that they're being advertised to, they are impressed because they're able to get in on the joke. They're part of the sarcasm. Colbert also did something really interesting that connects him back to the golden age of radio. Back in, I believe it was 2008 or 12, I can't remember which one, he ran for president. His presidential campaign was sponsored by Doritos. Completely ridiculous. But Gracie Allen did the same thing where she ran for president on the surprise party. That was the name of her party. And she borrowed a train from Union Pacific, getting a product placement in for them as well. All sorts of interesting connections between modern-day metadrama on television and in the golden age of radio.
On the phone with us is Dr. Quentin Varaghy. He's an assistant professor of English at UW-Barron County. He has written a chapter called Product Placement in the Golden Age of Radio, Why Tina Fey Owes a Debt of Gratitude to Jack Benny, in a book called We Are What We Sell, How Advertising Shapes American Life, and Always Has. You will probably admit to this suggestion that advertising today is lush and it's flourishing. There are still some subtle ways that we're pitched to, but much of it is blatant. And the reason for that is because there is so much out there to advertise, so much more than there was, for instance, back in the day of Jack Benny.
Absolutely. There's so much more to advertise, and I think another reason why it's so much more prevalent now is because viewers have become very sophisticated in ignoring the advertising and have the technology to ignore it. So then there's all sorts of clever ways in which advertisers nevertheless get their message across. Mm-hmm. In addition to product placement, one that I always find interesting is if you ever go on YouTube to watch, let's say, a Super Bowl commercial, before you can watch that commercial, you will have to watch a 15 to 30 second commercial.
The big thing nowadays, though, is naming rights to things. Look at all the bowl games, theater names. So that's another inroad for sponsors.
Football stadiums and basketball stadiums all have different naming rights.
Well, take a look at pro golfers. I mean, they're like walking billboards. They have product names on their collars and on their hats and on the back of the hat and back of their shirt. What do you think about the trend, being the student of popular culture as you are, and a teacher of not only English but more, whereby advertisers and their advertising producers and agencies, they have a need to be funny all the time? I often say, after seeing an ad that has very little product value in it, I would have loved to have been at the board meeting where that ad was pitched. If you listened to some of the messages that, for instance, Don Wilson would have read before and after a Jack Benny show, they always talked about the benefits, the traits of the product that they were selling. You don't get that a lot today. People just want to be funny, and then they slap a name on the end.
Yeah, there's not much information to a lot of advertisement. I've always thought that was sort of an interesting trend. I think that it's not always that they simply want to be funny, but they want to be memorable, whether they're funny or not. If they can associate their product with a positive feeling, mm-hmm. or positive emotion, then that association will be much stronger than any type of factual information they give you. Because I would assume the idea behind it is that people sort of make decisions with their heart and with their gut. The actual statistical information or what have you is going to be quickly forgotten or discarded.
Well, they've always used the term advertising game. You're in the advertising game. It seems to be more of a game today than ever.
I would say, from what I've observed, it's a much harder and more challenging game these days. People in the 21st century, I think, are much more cynical about advertising than they were in the past. If you listen to some of these old-time radio programs, they last along. Today, I think the goal is more to somehow reject or look past the advertisement.
Well, thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West. It's an interesting topic, and I know that in the future, whenever I have questions that concern either advertising or popular culture, I will call on you. Your list of credentials is impressive.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Quentin Varagee, UW-Barron County on Spectrum West.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Menominee Theater Guild production of Willy Wonka will play through Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The UW-Eau Claire Music and Theater Arts Department will present the musical A Man of No Importance through Saturday at the Riverside Theater of the Haas Fine Arts Center at the University. Whisper Into My Good Ear will be presented tonight, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The Festival Theater will also present its production of The Masquerade Friday at the Chateau St. Croix Winery. Disney's Mulan Jr., based on the 1998 Disney film Mulan, will be performed weekends through March 2nd by the Phipps Children's Theater at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Comedy Fair of Eau Claire will present two comedies tonight through Saturday at the Eau Claire Children's Theater's Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. The plays written by Jim and Jane Jeffries of Jest Scripts, Madrigal Dinners of Eau Claire, are Jack and the Franken Beanstalk and Kissing the Blarney Stone. The Northern Star Theater Company of Rice Lake will present the musical The Last 5 Years through Sunday. Love River Falls Style, an evening of one acts and desserts, will be staged by the River Falls Community Theater Friday and Saturday at Friends Bar and Grill in River Falls. Student performances of Three Billy Goats Gruff, a production of the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond, will be presented through Friday. And Elvis, The Essence of the King, featuring George Thomas, plays weekends and selected weekdays at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through March 2nd. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Yes, you are. Thank you, sir. Arts West 35 opens Sunday at the Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. And auditions for the fourth annual production of the Vagina Monologues will be held Friday from 5 to 6:30, Blue Hills Lecture Hall, UWBC, Rice Lake. Next week on Spectrum West, we'll meet the new guy at the top of the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. The Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra gives us some American gems, restoring pianos, and more. It's been wonderful having you with us here on Spectrum West. For this week, I'm Al Ross. Have a good Friday, a good weekend. Drive carefully in the weather that's impending, and we'll see you next week.